to show you.
Welcome to the 35th episode of the Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I'm Jackie DeVore, and I'm here with Sierra Houck.
Hello.
And Melissa Meegan.
Hi, hi.
Today we're going to be reading you some really cool stories. We're very excited about this particular topic. It's something that all three of us are very into listening the others tell us stories, so we're hoping that you guys will love us telling you stories.
Right, we're not going to make Sierra do all the hard work.
That's right, you guys tell me stories this there, time.
And Sierra's ready for it with a blanket all wrapped up there. Yeah. She just needs a cozy mug of cocoa. Before we get there, though, how about some recommendations? Sierra, what you got?
Originally, my recommendations were just going to be things that I wanted to buy that were horror-themed. But then, on the bus home today, I started this new Heaven's Gate podcast. I think it's the newest, like, one that's going around the true crime Facebook groups that I follow. It's 10 episodes. It's really well-produced. I think only the first episode is out so far. It's called Heaven's Gate. It is about the, not just about the event of the people committing suicide as the cult, but then also the history of the cult leading up to it and like the cultural context that it existed in the 70s. And then also what's super duper interesting, one is that they're going and like interviewing people who were in the group before the whole like it blew up and like people killed themselves. So people who had survived it. And then the host himself grew up in a super religious community where the church leader preached the end of days. And so they were all preparing for like Jesus's second coming, like tomorrow.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. So he has a really,
did he have the feeling that it would turn into like a Heaven's Gate kind of situation?
He was saying that.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. He, and then eventually the preacher died and it kind of like, he was supposed to lead them all to heaven. And so everybody kind of had this whole conflict of conscience and everything changed in their lives. And he adapted and he grew up. And then as an adult, he saw the news coverage of Heaven's Gate all going down. And he's saying that like he was worried to look at the people's faces because he might recognize somebody, because the kind of community that he was a part of would have totally gotten, you know, led down that path and could have been susceptible to that kind of a cult. So his perspective is super interesting too.
Oh wow.
So I'm super excited to listen to the rest of the episodes. And it's a mixture of interviews and his commentary, and then they have like recordings and, you know, the audio from like documentary footage and that kind of thing.
Oh wow. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. So that's the podcast that I'm currently obsessed over.
It sounds intense.
Yeah, but it's interesting because it talks about, you know, the religious aspect of the organization, but then also the kind of cultural acceptance of like sci-fi and how like sci-fi was getting really popular. And so people were thinking about extraterrestrials and UFOs and things like that. And then Heaven's Gate is about like the whole context is like, you don't have to die to go to heaven. You can follow this, the preaching, and like follow this way of life, and then aliens will take you to heaven. So it was like taking this idea of extraterrestrials that was kind of already in the cultural zeitgeist and then you're taking it really far.
Oh wow, that's so intense. I don't even know what to say to that. That sounds cool as shit though. Melissa, I know that you have some cool things to talk about. Let's hear them.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to you guys about the Lore TV show, because we've talked about the podcast quite a bit and how much we enjoy it. I don't know if either of you have watched any of the TV show yet.
I've watched the first couple episodes.
Yeah, me too. I've got like two or three under my belt.
I just thought it was a good time. I don't think we've mentioned it yet, have we? I don't think we've talked about it yet.
I don't think it came out last episode, like...
Yeah, I've only gotten a few through it, but I just wanted to talk about it briefly because I think that I have been really enjoying it so far. I think that it's important to say that, you know, it really is just the podcast. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not just the podcast, but it's the same stories that he has been telling on the podcast. What I think is really cool about it, and I'm not a fan of reenactments. I've said that on the show before. So sometimes it drives me crazy to see things like acted out while someone narrates what's happening.
You gotta find the joy and the cheesiness of it is the problem.
Mm-mm.
But all right.
But I don't think these are too cheesy.
Yeah.
I will say that. It's not been distracting me. What I really enjoy in this show is the animation.
Yeah, the animation is baller. I love it.
Yeah, it's got some really cool animation. I mean, the intro is really cool. I like the way it's put together. You know, it's kind of a combo of, like, animation and, like, little clips of reenactments of things and then little bits and pieces of just cool little, like...
informational graphics and such.
Yeah, like, informational stuff in between. It's really fun. It very much feels like a graphical representation of the podcast.
It's like next level education.
Yeah, like less so than a TV show, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like if you did like a graphic novel based on a podcast and then just made it move around is what it reminds me of. So yeah, I just thought it was worth mentioning. I do think it's enjoyable and I'm going to keep watching them. I think it was our friend Patrick who mentioned to me on Twitter that he was a little disappointed that it was just the podcast.
Yeah.
Kind of redone in a show, but I don't know. Like I said to him, I have kind of a short memory, so I've been listening to lore for a long time, so I don't remember all of these stories.
Fair enough.
So they seem new to me. But the other thing I'm super excited to tell you guys about is a comic book called Elena. And I discovered this because Dark Horse Comics was running, or actually, that's wrong, Comixology was running a horror comics sale recently. Cool. And they had a bunch of stuff from Dark Horse on there. And so this one is a little bit older. It's from August of 2016. And it's one that I'd never heard of before. It's written by Kim W. Anderson, and she's also the artist. It's really, really cool, and I think you guys would love it. And I don't know if we should do a show on it, but I also found out after reading it that there's a movie that was based on it, which I haven't seen, so I have to find that now and watch it. So just keep that in mind. There's actually a movie that was created off of this book because somebody enjoyed it so much that they decided to make it into a movie.
Dang.
So, and it's, it was a winner of Swedish Comic Academy's Adamson statue. And I have to say, like, I don't know anything about Swedish comics. So it was really interesting to me too, kind of an added thing, a big accomplishment in Sweden, because I don't know anything about Sweden comic book industry. So
that's really cool.
Yeah. It's about a girl named Elena. She's just started at a very snobbish boarding school. She comes from a troubled past, and she was sort of sent to the boarding school to get away from some of her trouble. She's been harassed every day by a couple of girls on the lacrosse team who are super popular. It's very kind of like Mean Girls vibe. Mm-hmm. Like, brutally harassed and bullied by these girls. Her best friend, Josephine, is constantly sort of trying to push her to be stronger and stand up for herself. When Elena decides that she doesn't want to fight back, then Josephine decides to step in and protect her best friend. The catch here is that Josephine is actually dead.
Well, all right then.
Josephine's death is the reason why Elena is at this boarding school, and Josephine's death is the past that she's trying to escape from.
Oh. Dang.
But Josephine is next to her the entire time, and this comic book also touches on sexual issues a bit. The relationship between these two girls is very complex. I think it is a matter of, what do I want to say this without giving away too much? I think that there it was a bit more of just a friendship between them, but Elena felt afraid of that and maybe ashamed of it to a certain extent, which affected their friendship a lot. So yeah, there's a lot of complex things being touched on in this comic book.
Very interesting.
But it's a great story, and it's very feels very much like a classic kind of like ghost story.
What's the name of the movie that's based on it?
I think it's just called Elena.
Hmm. I don't think I've even heard of it.
I found out because actually in the back of the comic book, they talk about the movie. Let me see. I might have gotten it backwards. Maybe that the book is based on the movie?
Well, the description on Dark...
The movie looks like it's... What?
The description on Dark Horse says, now a major motion picture, which seems like the comic would predate it.
Right, that's what I thought, but now the movie says 2015, and the comic says published in 2016 in Dark Horse, so...
Weird.
I don't know. One's a ghost of the other. So yeah, the film is also Swedish, so you'll have to read to watch it. But I think it looks really cool, and I'm gonna hunt down this movie and take a look at it.
Awesome.
The writers of the book seem to be very happy with what they did with the film, so. But it's cool. It's like Mean Girls with ghosts, and it's brutal. Like, there's things that happen in this that just, like, kind of shocked me a little bit. It's pretty brutal. I didn't expect quite the amount of, like, gore and blood that occurred in this book.
I just really hope that at some point somebody says, "Get in the car, loser. We're going haunting."
It's really cool. You guys have to check it out.
Right on. I do not have anything new for a recommendation this week, but I did want to back up Sierra's recommendation from last time. The Ghosts and the Burbs podcast. I've, like, really...
It's so good.
Fallen straight into the hole. I think there's, like, 30-something episodes now, and I've burned through almost all of them. Like, not only are the stories just extremely engaging and really fucking interesting, especially when you consider, like, they're supposedly all true, right? This shit is going on, like, just in fucking Massachusetts over there. Like, what is even happening in that town?
Yeah.
But Liz Sauer, she's just a natural storyteller. The way that she describes the people that she's interviewing and the experiences that she has just in the process of interviewing these people is phenomenal. Like, it really puts you in the moment there. Like, it makes you feel like you're really talking to these people and hearing their stories yourself, and it's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't really listen to many podcasts. I prefer talking on them, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, this one, like, I've really just put on my headphones and sat here and listened to it, almost all of it, in the past couple weeks. Kind of crazy.
I usually listen to a ton, but I got drawn into listening to Ready Player One, an audiobook. Oh, yeah, recently. Yeah. I desperately wanted to hear that story, and then everything else got put on hold until I finished it.
You're gonna have a lot of backlog there. Well, we're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna come back and tell you guys some scary stories.
Like a weird trombone, and the old ham bone is suddenly thrown. You are all alone with a great unknown in the haunted house.
Greetings, dear listeners. Tonight we invite you on a journey of dark whimsy. We encourage you to look in the shadows and find what's lurking there. Sit back and let us tell you some tales, and enjoy this brief moment of peace, because you may not be sleeping with the lights on afterwards. Our first presenter tonight is Sierra. Sierra, take us away.
This story is called The Arkansas Sleep Experiments. To those who sleep. This happened a few years ago. You may have heard rumors if you're on campus. Some even circulated online. Nobody knew what really happened, because I'm the only one who knows, and I kept quiet. For a multitude of reasons. None of them matter now. Here's what really happened. The four of us were handpicked for this experiment by Professor Richardson, because we'd all studied under him, worked under him, and much as anyone can, earned his confidence. He said this one was different. We had to keep it quiet. He wanted to keep the details to a minimum. All he would tell us before going in was that he required a month of our lives, and that if he succeeded, sleep would no longer be necessary. Think of it, he said. 6 to 8 additional hours every day. Your month will be paid back before the year is out. If he was right, he'd have the Nobel Prize for sure. It would change the world, and we all believed in him. Sleep would become nothing more than a hobby. Imagine that. We felt lucky to be part of it. We went in with the highest of hopes. We were so excited for the new future for humanity and for ourselves. And I was the only one to leave that place. Week 1. Professor Richardson brought us out to the location in his van, explaining along the way what we were to do. For the purposes of the study, we were asked to remain in the compound, as he called it. We would be locked in fact, and deprived of windows and Wi-Fi. Other than endure patiently, we wouldn't have to do much of anything. My machine does all the work, he explained. It uses a complex melange of sound waves to disrupt the processes of sleep, evolutionary appendices from the days before civilization. The most immediate side effects you'll notice is that you won't dream. Any other effects we noticed, we were to catalog. We were, as you would say, in uncharted territory, and so we had to map out the dangers. The immensity of the project was inspiring enough. Then we saw the compound, the octagon, as it was known. A concrete octagonal structure built at the end of a labyrinth of dirt roads somewhere in the backwoods of Searcy, Arkansas. I'd never been able to find it again. The professor said it was originally intended as a jail for terrorists, but it was abandoned and never used. It's virtually impenetrable, invisible to satellites, but for us it had been stocked with all of the comforts we'd require for a month of dedication. I didn't know if any of us accepted to really conquer sleep. We thought perhaps a reduction in sleep requirements could be possible. We spent a fair amount of those first 2 days speculating on how the machine works with its complex melange of sound waves, and whether sleep really is an evolutionary appendix, as the professor had claimed. By the third day of getting just 3 or 4 hours of sleep, contrary to feeling groggy, we were more awake and full of energy than ever. We were alert and ready to debate these ideas. That's when the excitement really hit us. "He really did it," JT said. JT was a big, ginger-bearded guy, the sort of guy who still has a healthy collection of magic cards. "We don't know that," James said, always the skeptic. He came from Australia just to study under Richardson, actually. The machine could be stimulating our adrenal glands to mildly dose us with adrenaline all throughout the day. "Even were that so, it wouldn't change the fact that he beat sleep," I said. With our extra time, we were getting in tons of readings, played a stupid amount of Call of Duty, and still had plenty of time to sit around and debate. "I guess I have to admit, it's fucking amazing," James said. We all felt it. It was almost euphoric, the excitement we felt for being possibly the first humans to live without the need to sleep. Technically, we still needed a few hours each night, but still, we had decided together that it was more out of habit than necessity. Then on the third day, Don said, "There's something wrong." Don was the serious one, superstitious. He used to be a Franciscan, I'd heard. It showed. He didn't talk that much, and when he did, it was usually worth listening to. This time, he put into words something I'd been feeling, but I guess I had just buried under the excitement. "With the experiment, or..." That was JT. "I don't know," he said. "It's a feeling. This constant uneasiness. Like this isn't going the way it's supposed to go, or that we're going in the wrong place." "No, no," James said. "I think that's it. I think it's the place." We all knew it was weird when we first saw it, this concrete octagon. But living in it, I think there's something wrong with this place, like something terrible happened here. "I understood it was never used," I said. "Governments always say that about torture prisons," James said. "It's more than that," JT said. "I feel it too. I thought it was just from lacking windows at first, but that's not it. I think it's the angles. It's like the angles in this building don't add up to what they should." "What if everyone's dead outside?" Don asked. James jumps up so fast that the chair clattered to the ground. "Cut that shit out, Don. Why would you even say that?"
"Yeah, Don."
"Well, what are you saying? That this is a haunted octagon?" "Yeah, James," JC said. "Was it built on an octagonal Indian burial ground?" "Okay, you want to play that?" he said. "I can play. Look, the space around us transforms based on how we perceive it. Take a church. The people who go there perceive it as holy. So then they do things like leave their crutches behind when they force themselves to walk, or light their candles, or whatever. These changes to the space only enhance the perception of holiness and influence future visitors to perceive it in the same way and change it in the same way. Haunted places are the same. For one reason or another, they begin to be perceived as haunted. The more they're perceived that way, the more they're imbued with hauntedness. Even if you've never seen the place before, you pick up on the subtle cues if you're at all sensitive. In a way, it's true to say it's a haunted place. It's true to say that a church is holy. Our interaction with the space has made it something more than just wood and sheetrock or whatever. So what I'm saying is, Maybe something's happened here and we're picking up on it. Some bloody awful things. And in that sense, yes, it's a haunted octagon. No, 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 Don said. Places are considered holy because an authority telegraphs it to whoever will listen. It's just like haunted places. They make money off of a lot of dumb tourists. Whatever it is, I said. We all agree something isn't feeling right about our situation. Maybe it's the machine. I say we write it down as a side effect. On that point, at least, we were all able to agree. It didn't put any of our uneasiness at rest, but we wrote it down. We somehow agreed upon the phrasing right away, too. Acute sensations that we've entered into something where we aren't welcome. Hmm. Week 2. We tried our best to ignore these feelings and carry on like we had been. Those few days had been some of the best days of our adult lives, but we never got back to those happy times. I realized around then how short-sighted of Richardson it was to leave us there without any means of contacting the outside world. When I voiced that opinion, that's just what I had been thinking, JT said. Richardson isn't a dumb guy, you get me? I think he does this on purpose. Why would you say that? For science, of course, he answered. It's one of those meta-studies where we're told it's about one thing when actually it's about how we react to the experiment, like Milgram's experiments. Or it's not his choice, James said. The government is making him do it, and that machine is designed to control us, or some kind of cult, Scientologists. This is a government-built installation, Daisy said, that actually makes sense. Not the Scientology part, though. Think about it, James started, but I interrupted. Okay, I said. Let's come back down to Earth for a second. Best case scenario, Richardson was just a jerk who doesn't care about our personal well-being, right? Give it a rest, Don said, the one I least expected to snap at me. Stop trying to act like all this the most rational guy in the room. You don't know what Richardson's into. He's into other things, he'll never talk about publicly. I looked at the others and saw similar confusion. What are you talking about? I've heard a little about this, actually, James said. He has some fringe ideas. Let's just say he's not the respected academic he presents himself to be, John said. I've read some of the content he doesn't publish. He thinks, and very seriously believes, that there's something else. Something besides this, he knocked on the table. Something more than material stuff. That's not completely strange, I said with a shrug. I was expecting worse. He put it this way, Don continued, ignoring me. Think back to the beginning of existence. There had to be conditions such that the universe's existence was possible. If the universe wasn't possible, then it wouldn't have come into existence. Does that stand to reason? We all nod. Okay, and those conditions cannot be material nor laws of matter since those things came into being with the existence of the universe. So whatever those conditions are, they have to be something other than the basic substance of the universe. Does that make sense? I guess, I said. This isn't turning into an argument for God, is it? He shook his head. It's an argument for something that continues to exist. Except we can't even say that because ideas like something and existing are developed by and for and within physical reality. This is something pre-physical, something pre-existence. Whatever it is allows the universe to spontaneously be. Who knows what else it's been doing for these billions of years? Just asking that question is already violating the stipulations, I started saying, my background in philosophy kicking in. Yes, Don said, but he believes. He thinks it's the source of free will. Our brains touch it somehow, and so he believes he can reach it, study it, and use it. I didn't get to read much more than that. And if this experiment is something he's not putting into his books, James added, it may have to do with his more peculiar interests. So instead of eliminating sleep, he's trying to make us see God, I said sarcastically. I don't know, bro. I'm just saying, if he thinks the brain touches another reality, this is just the kind of experiment he'd want to do to prove his theory. You think this room is bugged? JT asked. I think he might be in here somewhere, I said, without even thinking about what I was saying. They looked to me, waiting for an explanation, and with what looked like fear in their eyes. Strange we should be afraid of a man we admired less than 2 weeks ago. I sometimes feel someone is watching me in my sleep, I explained, my voice starting to tremble. I figured it was one of you at first. I feel it especially when I'm not quite awake, but not quite asleep. Those moments when you wake for a few seconds to adjust your pillow. I could tell and see and hear something was standing over me, just breathing and watching. And I was too close to unconsciousness to do anything about it. Then I just fall back asleep. I could see the terror filling the other's eyes while I spoke. I've been feeling it too, Don said, almost in a whisper, like he was scared to be heard. I thought I was losing it. Me too, James said. Someone else is in here, I said. We drew close together, our eyes darting nervously around the gray concrete room. We were all feeling the same thing, I'm sure. That we were trapped. trapped inside this horrible building with someone or something else. Wait, wait, JT said. What would this person be eating? We don't see our food disappearing. There's no way out. There isn't really anywhere to hide. We gotta start being sensible. Lal let out a sigh of relief. He was right. Okay, let's think about this, I said. Let's say it's another effect of the machine. Phase 2. Paranoia, Don said with a consenting nod. We wrote it down. The next day, when we all gathered together for breakfast, JT asked, Have you had any dreams? We all shook our head. Richardson was right on the money with that one. Mm-hmm. He said, Did you know that feral children don't dream? How do we know that? James asked. They tell us. The few that get socialized. They say dreaming is something that starts only after, when they have language, object permanence, and all that shit. What about dogs, like chasing rabbits through their sleep? Autonomic responses. Maybe language and object permanence impacts the ability to remember dreams, James said. Both are consistent with superficial data. The onus is on you to prove otherwise. JT scoffed. So what's your point anyways, Don asked. The point is, being dreamless, do you think it's healthy? I just don't think it's healthy. I think the machine isn't making us not sleep. It's making us just not feel tired. I think all this might be happening because we aren't dreaming. We can't really answer, can we? James said. Dreams naturally accompany REM sleep, so we don't have any studies that differentiate between the effects of not dreaming and not sleeping. Or maybe we are dreaming and the dreams are just going somewhere else, JT said. I didn't know what he meant by that. Nobody did. But we all stopped talking and then we dispersed. Something about it felt a little bit too true. Week 3. Our gatherings for theoretical discussions became rarer and rarer. We tended to isolate ourselves and eye each other with suspicion. I still had those feelings of uneasiness and unwelcomeness every day. And each night, the figure standing over me. I was sleeping even less now, maybe about an hour's tops, so little sleep that I'd started to catch it running away. The last time, I was awake enough to see where it was going. It's this one particular corner of my room that's always struck me as peculiar. I caught myself staring at it even when I don't want to. It's a play where angles are strange. My eyes have trouble focusing on it. The figure skulked straight into that point and disappeared into it. When I woke up fully, I questioned whether I'd hallucinated the whole thing. Perhaps phase 3 hallucinations. I went over to that corner and looked at it closely. It smelled strange, like turpentine. Then the more I stared at it, and the more I forced my eyes to focus, I was sure something was moving inside. And it was watching me. I heard this awful, hate-filled sound come from deep in the corner then. I didn't wait around to understand what had made that noise. I left that room for good. I took all my naps in the library from then on. While lying in the library, I overheard JT talking to someone in the corridor. He was telling them about the angles again. He said that there were more degrees in the building than can be possible in a standard enclosed shape. 2.7488 degrees more, he said. Just enough to drive you nuts, but not enough to make it obvious. Whoever he was talking to said something that I didn't understand. Something like, those are degrees of rippling. The voice was just distorted somehow, so I'm not really sure. What I was sure was, I didn't recognize the voice at all. Whoever JT was talking to wasn't one of us. Maybe silly, but I was scared. I stayed there, pretending to be asleep while JT walked by. And as he did, I felt someone or something come into the room and stand over me. Then it went away. After a minute so of telling myself I was just being foolish, I went and followed after JT. I didn't see him anywhere. I bumped into James, and he said he had also hadn't seen JT. Have you seen or heard anyone who shouldn't be in here? I asked him. James looked at me with a mixture of surprise and terror. How do you know? I haven't told anyone. About what? He told me he'd been hearing his mom calling to him. Not a faint sound that he could confuse for his mother, but her voice, clear as mine, calling out to him. He almost answered her, he said. Almost. Then he stopped himself. She's been dead for a year, man, he said. Whatever was calling me, it wasn't my mother. I saw that he was shaking and his hands were clenched. I told him to hang in there. We might be having hallucinations. I'd been hearing things too, a crying child, so low at first that I thought it was the plumbing. We should call a meeting, he said. I thought about JT and what I'd heard moments ago. Let's just tell Don, I said. As a side effect of the machine, it makes sense, Don said after we told him. The sounds are not supposed to be audible, yet somehow our brains are picking up on their random patterns and interpreting them as something. The brain assigns a memory to make the pattern meaningful. Do you believe that, I asked? Not for a second, said James. But we had a shortage of rational explanations, and that was a pretty good one, so I'd hoped it was right. A few days later, I found James in the gym, pounding away on a punching bag. I asked him if he was okay. He ignored me, so I went back into the reading room. A few minutes later, he was behind me. That voice I've been hearing is not my mother, he said. Of course not, I said. We'd already decided that, after all. No, I mean, I don't know what I mean. It's just my mother was a kind person. Even if this voice is trying to sound like her, it's not like her at all. It's not kind. It's not human. I put down my book and looked him full on to see if he was serious. He was, very much so. She's been telling me all sorts of things, he said. She asked if you remember the shed. I couldn't say anything to that. I was speechless. I never talked about that, and for good reason. Took me years to come to terms with what had happened. It was a long time ago. I was out playing behind our house in the woods, as I often did. I liked to construct shitty tree houses. I went a little off the property and came to the shed. I'd never seen it before. It looked old, though. I remember that. And I heard a kid crying inside. Thinking that I might have a friend to make tree houses with, I looked through the window. The kid was all chained up, and there was a dog bowl on the floor. I wanted to help, but I knew I was trespassing. I looked around. That's when I saw this man. Off about 20 feet into the woods. He was dressed in black, old-fashioned clothes, like 19th century clothes. He had to have been watching me the whole time, expressionless. I went running all the way home. I was so scared I didn't tell my parents about it until I was supposed to go to bed, and I had to explain why I was too terrified to go to sleep. They had the cops out there right away. They found the shed. I heard that they found the chains and the bowl, but the kid was gone. I've always blamed myself for not helping the kid right away. Do you? James asked. Yeah. Okay, well, she's been telling me how to get out. I looked at him without a word, because he sounded so manic. She said there's a secret exit inside JT. We have to cut him open to get to it.
Oh, shit.
James, I said, unsure what else to say at that point. Oh, I know, he said with a gulp. I know it's not true. I just have to tell someone. I don't know what's going on in this place, he said. I'm scared, man. And so was I. We had to get out of the octagon. Week 4. James and I started looking for ways out after that. Since we weren't sleeping at all now, we had plenty of time to do it. Every time we thought we'd found something, it was a dead end. It was a while we were doing that when we saw Don standing at the end of the corridor with his back to us. What's going on? James asked me. Something about it just seemed really strange. Don, are you okay? I called. He turned around and with a smile gave us a big wave. Bye, guys, he said, and walked around the corner. I looked at James to see if he was thinking the same thing as me, that something bad was about to happen, and he was already looking back at me. We took off running after him. He was at the end of the next corridor already, getting into an elevator. Don, no, we shouted, and ran after him, but the doors closed before we got there. He went up. The thing is, the octagon is a one-floor building. There's no elevator. Never has been, or after. I don't know where Don went, or if I really saw what I think I saw, but I know I never saw Don again. I don't understand, James said. What's happening? Before we could take time to think about it, a group of people rounded the corner and were walking towards us. I think we should go, I said. Who are they? He asked. James, let's go. Why are they blurry? I don't know, but we're going. I grabbed his arm and pulled him away with me, and we ran. I ran until I got to the kitchen and hid myself between the wall and the fridge. I was sure James was right behind me. I could hear his footfall the whole way, but when I looked, he was gone. I stayed there until my body couldn't really take it anymore, probably a few hours. While I slipped out, I saw someone peering at me from around the doorway. I was so startled, I backed up against the wall. It was a little boy. Hello? I asked. Then I heard screams. The boy was gone. More screams. I couldn't just leave somebody in distress. Not again. I ran towards the screams, scared of what might be happening to James. I heard a scream again, this one choked out. It was coming from JT's room. I wished then and still wish that I hadn't opened the door. James was in there. He'd sliced JT open and he was feeling around in his guts. I was shocked. Agonized, expression was frozen on JT's face. What did you do? I asked. I have to get out, James said as he dug through JT's intestines. I backed out of the room. I didn't know what else to do. I just had to find somewhere to hide until Richardson could get us out of there. Once I was out of the room, I heard James saying, "Mom?" And then, "Oh no, oh no," and then he screamed. I ran back in. James was gone. The doorway to the room hadn't left my sight. There was no way he could have gotten out, but he was gone. And noxious black smoke was coming out of JT's abdomen. It smelled like burning tires. I went back into the kitchen. I found a supply of candles. I melted some wax into paper towels and I stuffed my ears with it. Then I curled up in the corner with my eyes closed and waited for sleep to come. I waited a long time, but eventually it came. When I woke up, Professor Richardson was shaking me. He had already pulled the paper towels out of my ears. I thought he'd come early. I found out later that I had been asleep for several days. He asked me where the others went, and I told him everything, as much as I understood. I tried to take him to JT's body, but it was gone. There was not a trace of blood. He took me to the hospital after to make sure that I was okay. "I'll foot the bill," he said. "Also, you can forget about your student loans." "Is that how it is?" I asked. "I put you in danger," he said, "so yes, you've earned it, if you keep quiet." I told him that I couldn't keep quiet because of what happened to the others. "You don't think those things really happened, do you? Would all the laws of the physical universe suspend themselves for just you four? No, those were waking dreams. You weren't supposed to dream at all. I thought I'd compensated for it. The machine needs tweaking. That's science. The others are fine. They'll be laying low for a while until I publish the results. Please do the same." I wanted to believe him. I've always considered myself a rational person. I just don't believe him. Yes, it all could have been a dream. That would have been the simplest explanation. But it was no dream. I tried to find the others. I never could. I don't think they're fine at all. I tried to tell the police about it, but they wanted evidence. I couldn't even show them the octagon. James, JT, Dawn, if you're out there and read this, let me know that you're okay. And everybody else, let me know what you think. I think Professor Richardson was right about one thing. Sleep really is something we evolved to protect us, except not from the creatures that roam the forest at night. It protects us from something much worse, something all around us. It's not obsolete at all. Think whatever you believe in, that you have sleep and that you can dream.
They say I'm mad. He's mad, he's mad.
The man is mad.
I love that story.
Those were the sleep experiments. Sorry, it was a long one.
No, it was great. Also, the smoke and the burning oil smell. Did anybody else think Bob? Yep. Is that Bob?
Yeah, no.
Think what?
I totally thought Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks reference.
Oh.
I liked it because it had like some sleep paralysis kind of stuff and like definitely Twin Peaks-y vibes.
My story is called "The Eyes Are Watching Me." I bought a new house in the small town of Winthrop. The house was cheap, but the most important part was that I needed to get away from the city. A few months ago, I had a run-in with a stalker. While I managed to get him arrested, I couldn't shake the feeling of eyes just constantly watching me. I felt like there were eyes everywhere, at home and on the street, so I decided to move out into the country to somewhere with less people, just for peace of mind. The house itself was big and old, but otherwise very welcoming. The agent who introduced me to the house had been required to mention that a serial killer had lived there in the past, which was why the house was so cheap. However, he and later my next-door neighbor Sarah both told me to pay the thought no mind. Four other owners had lived in the house since then, and all of them were very happy with it. I love the house. Its interior furnishings were beautiful and very comfortable. The people of Winthrop were friendly, often bringing over fresh baked pastries or inviting me for dinner. Get-togethers, they said, were the key to making sure everyone who lived in Winthrop loved it there. Yet after a week, I stopped loving it. The feeling of someone watching returned, worse than ever before. I tried to ignore it, but soon I started losing sleep. Giant bags grew under my eyes, and I began yawning almost as much as I breathed. Sarah was kind enough to let me stay in her house for a few nights. It was during this time that I heard the legend of Forrest Carter, the serial killer who had lived in my house. While no one knows his exact kill count, Carter, also known as the Winthrop Peacock, was a man with extremely severe case of narcissism. Legends say that he couldn't fall asleep if he didn't feel like he was being watched. He was finally arrested for putting up a scarecrow to watch him during the night. Only it wasn't a scarecrow. Carter had murdered a 17-year-old girl just so her corpse could stare at him. The story gave me shivers, and after I went home, I felt like there were hundreds of pairs of eyes just watching me, no matter how I turned. Today, however, was the first day that I acted out. I was cooking breakfast when I felt the eyes. Instinctively, out of fear, I threw my kitchen knife, which lodged itself into the wall. As I pulled it out, I found myself staring at a pair of eyes, pickling in formaldehyde. I've been watching the police peel away the drywall of my house for hours now. So far, they found 142 pairs of eyes in little glass jars.
Oh my God.
The scariest thing is, each and every one was staring at me.
Oh no.
That's the end.
Oh God, that was a good one.
I hope that gave you shivers.
I want that one to be longer. Mm-hmm. I want to know what happens next.
Gotta leave a little bit to the imagination, right?
For sure. Mine is called 63 Years Ago, and it's by Jacob Healy. It's official, I'm an old man. For the last couple years, I've comforted myself by saying I'm in my, quote, early 70s, but math is simple and unforgiving. Today is my 75th birthday, and God, the years do fly. I'm not here for your well wishes. This is hardly a milestone I'm excited about. I'm glad to still be here, of course, but I find I have less and less to live for with every passing year. My bones ache, my kids live far away, and the other side of my bed has been empty for just over 8 months now. In fact, once I cast my vote against that goddamn Trump this November, I may have nothing to live for at all. So spare me your happy birthdays and your congratulations, if you please. I'm here because I have a story for you, and it's one I've never told before. I used to think I kept it inside because it was silly, or maybe because nobody would believe it. I found, though, that the older you grow, the more exhausting it becomes to lie to yourself. If I'm being perfectly honest, I've never told anybody this story because it scares me, almost to death. But death seems friendlier than it used to, so listen close. The year was 1950, the setting of a small town in Maine. I was a boy of 9, rather small for my age, with only one friend in the world to speak of, and his family, seemingly on a whim, decided to move 2,000 miles away. It was shaping up to be the worst summer of my life. My pop wasn't around, and mom was a chore whore. Boy, was I proud of myself when I came up with that one. So I wasn't apt to hang around the house. With some hesitation, I decided the public library was the place to be that summer. The library's collection of books, particularly children's books, was meager to say the least, but within the walls of that miserly structure, I would find no undone chores, no nagging mother, God rest her soul, and perhaps more importantly, no other children with whom I would be expected to associate. I was the only kid with a low enough social status to spend his precious days of freedom sulking amid the bookshelves, and that was just fine with me. The first half of my summer was even more dreadful than I had imagined it would be. I would sleep in until around 10, do my chores, and then ride my bike to the library. And by bike, I mean rusty log of shit attached to a pair of wheels. Once there, I would split my time between unintentionally annoying the elderly patrons and deliberately doing so. One pleasant lady actually interrupted my incessant tongue-clicking to hiss a "shut the fuck up" at me. The first time I ever heard a grown-up use the F-word. Big fucking deal, I know. But in those days, it was unheard of. The dreary days turned to woeful weeks. I had actually begun praying for school to start again, until I discovered the basement. I could have sworn I roamed every inch of that library, but one day, in the far corner, behind the foreign language collection, I stumbled across a small wooden door I'd never seen before. That was where it all began. The door was windowless and made from oak that looked far older than the wall in which it rested. It had a knob of black metal that quite literally looked ancient. I wouldn't have been surprised to learn it was crafted in the 17th century. Engraved on the knob was what appeared to be a single footprint. I had the sense that whatever lay beyond this door was forbidden to me, and therefore probably the most interesting thing I would encounter all summer. I quickly glanced around to make sure nobody was watching me, then turned the heavy knob and slipped behind the door and shut it. But there was nothing, only darkness. I took a couple steps and then stopped, unnerved by the totality of the shadow which surrounded me. I waved my hands in front of me in an attempt to find a wall or a shelf or anything to hold on to. What I actually found was more subtle, a small string dangling from above, but far more useful. I grabbed it and firmly pulled it down. Back in the day, lots of light bulbs were operated with strings, and this was one of them. My surroundings were instantly illuminated. I was standing on a small, dusty platform that looked as though it hadn't seen life in quite some time. To my left was a crickety-ass spiral staircase made of wood and appearing ready to collapse at any second. The bulb was the only source of light in the room, and it was feeble, so when I peered over the railing to see what lay below, the bottom of the staircase dissolved into darkness. I was beginning to feel scared. This place, wherever I was, seemed to have no business in a town library. It was as though I were in a completely different building, but no 9-year-old likes to let a mystery go unsolved. Looking back, I wish I could tell my prepubescent self to turn around, go back, do anything else besides descending that staircase. You'll be spared a lot of sleepless nights, I'd say, but, of course, I didn't know that then, and may not have listened to myself even if I had. So instead of turning back, I took a deep breath, gripped the railing, and glared resolutely forward as I began my descent. The wood on the railing was dry and covered with splinters. I immediately let go, holding my hands out for balance as I carefully traversed the staircase. It was, or at least seemed, very long, and with only the dim glow of the string bulb far above me, my heart pounded mercilessly in the darkness. Even kids can sense when something isn't right, I think. They just don't always give a shit. By the time my feet reached the cement floor at the bottom, the light from the bulb above was nearly a memory. But there was a new light source, and God, I'll never forget it. Directly in front of me was a door, massive and a deep shade of red. The light was coming from behind the door, and it shone out in thin lines from all four sides, a sinister, dimly glowing rectangle. For the second time, I took a deep breath and went through a door I shouldn't have. In contrast to the dank room I entered from, the room behind the door was blinding. When my eyes adjusted, what I saw nearly took my breath away. It was a library, the most perfect library imaginable. I gaped in wonder as I stepped almost reverently further into the room. It was beautiful. It was smaller than the library above, much smaller. But it seemed to be almost tailor-made for me. The shelves were packed with brightly colored titles. Both armchairs in the middle of the room were exquisitely comfortable. And the smell, my God, the smell, was simply unbelievable. Sort of a mixture of citrus and pine. I simply can't do it justice with words, so I'll suffice it to say I've never smelled anything better, not in my 75 years. What was this room? Why had I never heard of it before? Why was nobody else here? Those were the questions I should have been asking, but I was intoxicated. As I gazed around at all the books and baths and the smell of paradise, I could only form one thought. I will never be bored again. In truth, boredom only hid from me for 3 years. It was on my 12th birthday, 63 years ago to this day, that everything changed. Before that, I visited the basement sanctuary as often as I could, usually several times a week. I never saw another soul down there, yet strangely remained free of suspicion. I never removed a book from that room, but instead would pick up a particular volume wherever I had stopped reading during my previous visit. I sat always in the same deep purple armchair, and always leaving its twin baron directly across from myself. That armchair was mine. The other one was, well, I suppose I couldn't have articulated it then much better than I can now, but it wasn't mine, that's for damn sure. On my 12th birthday, I arrived later than usual. My mom had invited a couple classmates and some cousins over for our house to celebrate, a gesture which I found more tedious than touching, really. I just wanted to spend my birthday sitting and reading and smelling paradise. Eventually, our guests went home, and I made it to the library about 15 minutes before closing. That didn't matter. The workers never checked down there before they locked up. I was free to stay as late as I wished. This particular night, I was devouring the final chapters of an epic adventure, knights, swords, dragons, and the like. I didn't smell it until I read the final words and closed the book. The once exquisite aroma of that room had turned sour. I sat for a moment, unsettled. Objectively, I could recognize that smell was actually the same as it had been before, the mixture of citrus and pine. I just perceived it differently, and I didn't like it anymore. It was a nasal version of an optical illusion. You know, the one that looks like a young woman glancing backward, but all of a sudden, you see that it's really an old woman facing towards you? You can't unsee that, and I couldn't unsmell this. The spell was broken. The odor also seemed, for the first time, to be coming from somewhere specific. With a fair amount of trepidation, I stalked around the room, sniffing the air like a crazed canine, until I came across a shelf near the back. The shelf was perfectly normal, with the exception of one title. A large, leather-bound cover of solid faded maroon, with one striking black footprint at the top of the spine. This was the source of the smell. I opened the front cover and saw one sentence scrawled neatly in blood-red ink atop the first page. "Rest your sorrows down, friend, and leave them where they lie." I stared at the sentence, mesmerized, as I began to retreat to my chair. I turned a page, blank. The smell became stronger. Another page, blank, and the smell grew stronger still. I stopped for a moment and suppressed a gag and continued walking. Then, as I neared the armchairs, I turned one final page, and there, in the same sinister print, was the last thing I expected to see. My own name. I dropped the book. I began to sprint toward the door, but as I shifted my gaze forward, my heart leapt to my throat and I stopped in my tracks. The empty chair wasn't empty anymore. An aged man sat before me, one leg crossed over the other, contemplating me with piercing gray eyes and a light smirk. This was all too much. I fell to my knees and expelled the contents of my stomach onto the carpet. I wiped my mouth, staring at my vomit, when I heard the man let out a chuckle. I stared at him disbelievingly. "Who are you?" I asked, panic in my voice. The man leapt to his feet, grabbed me gently by the shoulders, and helped me to my chair. He sat once again in his own. "I fear we got off to a bad start," he said, glancing at the pile of sick on the carpet. "The smell, it does take some getting used to." "Who are you?" I repeated. "Tonight, you will know hardship like you've never known before," he said. "I come as a friend, offering you refuge from it, and from all other storms which lie ahead." I wanted nothing more than to leave at that moment, but I remained seated. I asked him what he was talking about. "Your mother is dead, my boy, by her own hand, in her kitchen." "The scene is gruesome, I must admit," he said in a sorrowful tone, but there was a playful glint in his eye. "Surely you wish to avoid this path. I can show you a safer one." My blood ran cold at the horrors this man spoke of, but I did not believe him. "What do you want from me?" I demanded, trying to sound braver than I felt. He laughed, an old, raspy yelp that seemed to shake him to his bones. "Nothing but your friendship, dear boy," he said. Then, sensing I found his answer inadequate, he expounded, "I want you to come on a journey with me. My work is noble, and you will make a fine apprentice. And maybe when I'm done," he sighed tiredly, running his bony fingers through his thin white hair, "maybe then my work can be yours." I stood up, shuffling toward the door but never breaking his gaze. "You're crazy," I told him. "My mom isn't dead. She's not." "See for yourself, if you must," he said, gesturing toward the door. I threw him a contemptuous glare and bolted for the exit. As my hand closed around the knob, he said my name softly. In spite of myself, I turned around. "Your road won't be easy, friend. If it ever becomes too much for you, and I mean ever," he said, pausing to sweep his hand over the room, "you know where to find me." I slammed the door behind me and took the decrepit stairs two at a time. I exited the library, clambered onto my bike, and hightailed it home. The front door was wide open. I dismounted, leaving my bike in a heap on the ground, and approached the house cautiously. The old man was lying. He must have been. Still, tears began to sting my eyes. Heart pounding, I stepped inside and called for my mother. I heard no answer, so I turned to the kitchen. To this day, I still don't know why she did it. I've lived in that small town in Maine my entire life. Although I've kept mostly clear of the public library, once in my late 20s, I summoned the courage to step inside. Life was good at the time, and my fear had begun to morph into idle curiosity. Where the door to the basement sanctuary once stood was only a blank wall. I asked the librarian what had become of that basement, though in my heart I knew the answer. There was no basement, she said. There had never been a basement. In fact, if she had her facts right, city zoning ordinances prevented a basement in that area. I've been haunted by that sickly sweet smell, that poisonous blend of citrus and pine, ever since that long ago birthday. When I saw my mother in the kitchen that day collapse in a pool of her own blood, I smelled it. When a man claiming to be my father knocked on my college apartment door, begged me for money, and beat me to within an inch of my life when I refused, I smelled it. When my wife miscarried our second child, I smelled it. And again when she miscarried our fourth. When our oldest son got behind the wheel of the family Buick completely shit-faced and got his girlfriend killed, I smelled it. I began to smell it periodically as my wife became sick. She died late last year. And now, I'm alone for the first time in more than half a century. Now I smell it every day, and it feels like an invitation. A few months ago, I went back to the library, and the small oak door with the ancient handle was there, right where it used to be. My evening walk has brought me past that library every day since, but I haven't gone inside. Maybe tonight I will. I'm frightened to die, yes, but lately, I'm even more frightened to keep living. The old man was right. My road hasn't been easy, and I doubt it would get any easier. Rest your sorrows down, friend, and leave them where they lie. He promised relief, a refuge, he said. Was he right about that, too? There's only one way to find out. After all, I still know where to find him.
Put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Do, 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 do. You better stop the things you do. I ain't lying.
It's the devil.
Oh, like the Grim Reaper's library.
Yeah.
Worst birthday ever.
That was kind of heartbreaking, right? Jackie. Thanks.
You're welcome. I'll have you know that I skipped over the story of a very creepy child just for you.
I don't mind creepy children, but I had to skip over a lot of stories about children being murdered and various things happen to children.
Yeah, this one had things happening to a child. It was a baby at that. Like, it was a small child. And I was like, this,
no thanks.
I was like, this one's really gonna bug Melissa. Let's not.
I almost didn't do the eyes story because I was worried that you would have a weird eyeball problem, but
if they had, like, you know, if they had described touching the eyes, then I would have been out. I was like, when you were talking about all the eyes that they were pulling out, I was like, don't talk
don't
about
squish
them being,
don't touch them.
Yeah, don't squish them.
Accidentally poking your finger into an eyeball on the wall.
You know I can't stand it. You're running around. You know better, daddy. I can't stand it because you put me down. Yeah, yeah.
This one is called Daycare.
It's creepy already.
Yep. I recently put my daughter in daycare. I didn't really want to, but being that I'm a single parent, I don't have much choice. After dubious research, I found a daycare center that seemed like a good fit. It was run by a girl named Wendy and seemed fairly popular in the neighborhood, as there were a number of kids there when I went to investigate. One of the things that I particularly liked about it was the fact that they had security cameras set up around the center so that parents can get access to them and check on their kids. It quickly became an obsession of mine. All the kids wore jackets that the daycare provided because the air conditioner had been on the fritz, so it was quite cold in there, but it was easy to tell which of the little girls was mine. I loved being able to watch my daughter play with other kids as I worked, and it gave me peace of mind, knowing that she was doing all right. I couldn't keep my eyes glued to the screen the entire time, but in passing I saw that she had made a friend that she played with almost every day, and even had a favorite toy. It was a little medicine ball that she and her friend would toss back and forth. They played with it every day. After about a week, things seemed to be going pretty well. My little girl had started getting the grasp of potty training and was being more well-behaved than ever, and needless to say, I was pretty impressed with the daycare. And that was when she started singing the song. She hummed it at first, and when I asked her what it was, she told me it was a song that they taught her at daycare. Eventually, she learned all the words and she began to sing. Sweet, their teeth sweet, their bones and slit, their throats inside their homes. We sing the song, and when we're done, we'll go to hell and have more fun. She sang it all the time, no matter how many times I told her to stop. It made my skin crawl. Why would they teach a song like that to children? The next day, with the song stuck in my head, I resolved to call Wendy. I wanted to tell her that I disapproved of that song, and I didn't want that or anything else like it being taught to my daughter. If it continued, I would be forced to find a new daycare. As I watched the children playing on my computer screen, my little girl playing with the ball like she always did, I picked up my phone and called the daycare. When Wendy answered, I told her about my concern. She was incredibly polite and about it and said that one of the other kids had been going around singing it. She said that she thought it was from a movie or something, but she was working on putting a stop to it because it was definitely not a song for children. She said it disturbed her just as much as it disturbed me. I'd been pacing around my office as I spoke to her, and just as we were saying goodbye, I looked back down at the screen and noticed something peculiar. The Wendy on the screen was not on the phone. She was helping a kid with his juice box. She said goodbye and hung up the phone, and I watched the cameras not reciprocating her farewell, but transfixed on the screen in front of me. I stared at my daughter and her playing with her ball, and tried to think of how many times I'd seen her drop it as they tossed it back and forth. I didn't think I'd seen that happen very much at all. And the kid in the corner was always in the corner, working on the same puzzle. How long had he been working on that puzzle? And that's when I began to suspect that instead of watching a live feed, I'd been watching a recording. Dun dun dun! That's where it ends. Shit's going down at that daycare!
The kids are actually eating each other's teeth and bones.
Yeah. I like that one, but I don't know why they mention that the kids wear jackets because the air conditioner was messed up. Like, I thought that would be a plot point, and then it doesn't come back to that at all. I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, this one is called They Got the Definition Wrong. It has been said that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. I understand the sentiment behind the saying, but it's wrong. I entered the building on a bet. I was strapped for cash and didn't buy into the old legends of the hotel to begin with, so $50 was more than enough to get me to do it. It was simple. Just reach the top floor, the 45th floor, shine my flashlight from a window. The hotel was old and broken, including the elevator, so that meant hiking up the stairs. So up the stairs I went. As I reached each platform, I noted the old brass plaques displaying the floor numbers. 15, 16, 17, 18. I felt a little tired as I crept higher, but so far, no ghosts, no cannibals, no demons. Piece of cake. I can't tell you how happy I was as I entered that last stretch of numbers. I joyfully counted them aloud at each platform. 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 44. I stopped and looked back down the stairs. I must have miscounted, so I continued up. 44. One more flight, 44. And then down 10 flights, 44. 15 flights, 44. And so it's been for as long as I can remember. So really, insanity isn't doing something repeatedly and expecting different results. It's knowing that the results will never ever change. That each door leads to the same staircase, to the same number. It's realizing you no longer fall asleep. It's not knowing whether you've been running for days or weeks or years. It's when the sobbing slowly turns into laughter.
Damn.
That's it.
Fun.
44, 44,
44.
44. That's the idea of my ultimate nightmare, I think, is having to walk upstairs for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Get stuck climbing staircases.
So how about we go through and read a couple of these two-sentence horror stories?
Mm-hmm.
Two-sentence horror stories, okay.
Before we wrap this up here, I will start us off. A few hours after I was buried alive, I was thrilled when I heard someone digging me out. My joy quickly faded when I realized the sound was coming from under me.
Ew.
Yeah.
It's childish, but when I leave the basement, I always run up the stairs while glancing behind me. I was looking in the wrong direction.
Uh-oh.
I woke at 3:33 a.m. to find a huge black demon standing at the foot of my bed, his curved talons raised in readiness. I had drawn a breath for what was sure to be my dying scream when he dived into bed beside me and whispered in a frantic voice, "Hide me, he's coming."
I like that one. It wasn't a virus that caused people to start eating each other. It was the taste.
Yummy.
Humans are yummy.
Yummy.
Well, I think that actually wraps us up for this story time. Fun time. Did you guys enjoy the stories?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to read more now.
Well, we'll definitely have another one of these episodes, I think. This was a lot of fun, just reading stories to each other. So, The Sirens Who Scream is a member of the Mega Nerd Media family. Visit MegaNerdMedia.com for geek-related columns, reviews, interviews, and videos. If you've been enjoying our happy little horror show, please remember to leave us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever platform you use there. This helps us grow our audience so that we can keep doing these cool things. We also love being guests on other podcasts. If you have a cast you'd like us to sit in on or a suggestion for us, we're all ears. And that includes topics, too. If you have any kind of topic that you think that we should cover or would like to hear our opinions on, definitely send that our way. You can reach us via email at sos@meganerdmedia.com, on Twitter and Tumblr as @SirensOfScream. And you can find past episodes, show notes, recommendations, and links and more at SirensOfScream.com. Sierra, where can people find you? Oh, I think Sierra's gone. She's at Sierra Halk. All over the internet. I'll just do that for her. She's already gone. Melissa, where can people find you?
You can find me at Listapunch on Instagram and Twitter, and you can also find me on the Talking Comics podcast.
Ooh. And I am Jackie the Robot on Twitter and Instagram. We hope you have a very spooky Halloween.
Happy Halloween!
There's an old deserted mansion on an old forgotten road where the better ghosts and goblins always hang out. One night they threw a party in a manner a la mode, and they cordially invited all the gang out. At a dark, bewitching hour, when the fun was loud and hearty, a notorious wallflower became the life of the party. The spooks were having their midnight fling. Mary Megan was in full swing. They shrieked themselves into a cheerful trance. When the skeleton in the closet started to dance. Now a goblin, he giggled with fiendish glee. A shout rang out from a big banshee. Amazement was in every ghostly glance. wind skeleton in the closet started to dance. Now all the witches were in stitches while his steps made rhythmic thumps. And they nearly dropped their broomsticks when he tried to do the bumps. You never heard such an earthly laughter or such hilarious groan when skeleton in the closet rattled his bones.
Any more.